Live from the nation's capital, President Joe Biden and comedian Colin Jost headlined the White House Correspondents' Dinner. See all the biggest stars together in one room live April 27th at 8 p.m. on CNN and streaming on Max.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the, we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Happening now, we're standing by for an update from top officials on the bridge collapse in Baltimore and the underwater search for victims. The investigation intensifying, with the NTSB now reviewing the crashed cargo ship's data recorder and launching interviews with crew members. Also tonight, my one-on-one interview with retired U.S. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. He's opening up about his concerns about the direction of the high court, the decision to overturn Roe versus Wade, and his own legacy. Welcome to our viewers here in the United States and around the world. I'm Wolf Blitzer. You're in the Situation Room. We could get critically important new information about the bridge collapse investigation and the recovery efforts very, very soon. The Maryland governor and other top officials, they are now getting ready to hold a news conference in Baltimore. Should begin very soon. We'll carry it live. Right now, let's check in with CNN's Pete Buntin. He's joining us live from Baltimore. Pete, I understand there's been a lot of new action today over at the scene of this disaster where you are.
Both have now recovered the MV Dolly's black
box. Are unfolding for investigators now getting their first look inside the crippled MV Dolly cargo ship. The latest goal is piecing together the final frantic moments on board the ship as it careened helplessly out of control and into Baltimore's Key Bridge, causing it to collapse. Six contractors doing pothole repair are now presumed dead.
Our thoughts and prayers are with their loved ones whose lives are never going to be the same.
The latest discovery, the Dolly's black box. Known as a voyage data recorder, the Dolly's has been recovered and is being analyzed by the National Transportation Safety Board.
We've sent that back to our lab to evaluate and begin to develop a timeline of events that led up to the strike on the bridge. And we hope to have that information to share with the public later today.
The recorder captures data like heading, speed, and water depth, as well as the condition of the engines, thrusters, and rudder, but also audio on the ship's bridge, where the crew called for dropping anchor in a last-ditch emergency maneuver.
The pilot made all of the right calls in a timely manner, but the voice recorder will confirm that. And I think this investigation, all of the pieces are in place to have a successful, conclusion. The real challenge will be, how do you prevent this from happening again?
The search for the missing Wednesday, hamstrung by poor weather and heavy rain, deemed too dangerous to continue among the jagged pieces of the bridge in the murky Patapsco River.
You could have 20 parts that are suddenly going to change position. Diver could be dead in a matter of seconds and he wouldn't even know it.
Still unaccounted for, Salvadoran father of three, Miguel Luna, along with Honduran father of two, Maynor Sandoval, whose brother is still holding out hope.
Yes, we still have hope till this moment. God grant the miracle. It would be beautiful. For us and the family in Honduras, we still have hope. I know time is our worst enemy.
Pete Muntean reporting for us from Baltimore. Thank you, Pete, very much. As we get closer and closer to that briefing in Baltimore, I want to bring in right now Congressman Kwaise Mfume. He's a Democrat of Maryland. His district includes both the Baltimore port and the collapsed bridge area. Congressman, thanks so much for joining us. As we stand by for this update at this news conference, is there any new information you can share about the recovery efforts and the ongoing investigation into this horrible, horrible bridge collapse?
Thank you, Wolf. The investigation is very, very important, and they should leave no stone unturned. May everything from the point of the loss of navigation to the inability to turn the ship, to the impact and the collapse of the bridge and the deaths that occurred thereafter. It's gonna require an extensive amount of background and an extensive amount of research. And so the NTSB, the FBI, the Coast Guard, and our local assets, including the Transportation Secretary and the Secretary on the national level, Mr. Buttigieg, are all working to get this done. It is so very important because you don't want this sort of thing ever happening again. And with a ship that's the length of 3 football fields with 4,000 containers and weighing 95,000 pounds, that was an accident waiting to happen. And so the navigation aspect of this, which we think is mechanical right now, looks like it caused the accident, but we're not sure until that's completed.
Yeah, they got to complete that investigation. We're learning more and more, Congressman, about the victims of this collapse. A father of 3 from El Salvador, a father of 2 from Honduras, a Guatemalan, Mexican nationals. Have you had a chance to speak to any of the families, and what support will you offer to them?
No, the families were sequestered deliberately out of the way of everyone yesterday and probably for most of the day. Both of those gentlemen you mentioned have been in the country for 18 or 19 years, raising families, paying taxes, doing whatever they could do to get work. Some of them work 2 and 3 jobs. And so this is a tragedy that should not be beset on anyone. This family, and these 6 families, I should say, are very, very much impacted, as of course we know they are. And I think the main thing right now is twofold. Do what we can to support these families at this hour of real tragedy, and then do what we can to support the 15,000 workers who are out of work effectively now, who work in the port as a result of the inability for ships to come in and out. About 35,000 people a day go across that bridge, and so it's been a lifeline, an artery to both sides of Baltimore City and Baltimore County. And the key right now is to try to find a way, once we do those other things, to dredge and to get all of that scrap out of the water, because you can't put a vessel through there as long as you don't know what's underneath the surface.
Yeah, important point. You heard the Transportation Secretary Buttigieg say rebuilding this bridge won't be quick, won't be easy or cheap. What steps, Congressman, are you taking right now to ensure that Congress funds both the short and long-term needs of your community?
Well, the secretary was right. It's actually going to take months to clear out the debris. When I say debris, I'm talking about steel now. And it's going to take a couple of years to rebuild this bridge. I mean, we don't want to play games about this. This is going to be a long process. Fortunately, I talked to President Biden yesterday, spent time with Secretary Buttigieg, and both of our senators, Senator Cardin and Senator Van Hollen, have been in touch with the leadership on the Senate side, myself on the House side, so that we're able to put together a strategy to get an emergency supplemental. There's got to be an appropriation. And I think what I'm sensing, Wolf, around the country is that people, regardless of their political affiliation or where they live, have a sense of loss here, a sense like we've all been wounded by this. And so I'm hoping that that appropriation process does not get hung up in politics. The president will put forth what he's going to do, but the Congress controls the purse strings. And so we're going to need a major appropriation, a supplemental to begin with, and several after that to be able to do what we want to do here.
Yeah, it's going to take quite a while. As someone who's driven over that bridge many, many times over the years, it's so heartbreaking to see what happened. Congressman Kwaise Mfume, thank you very much for all you're doing. Thanks very much for joining us. Right now, I want to bring in 2 experts, CNN transportation analyst Mary Schiavo and Captain Joseph Ullstrom, a maritime safety management instructor. And Mary, let me start with you. Now that the investigators have more information from boarding the actual ship and getting its data recorder, How will they work to determine exactly what went wrong and who should be held accountable?
Well, the NTSB works in work groups, and that's the only way to tackle a job this big. They will call in and include in their investigation many different parties. The parties will be obviously the shipping crew, the harbor pilots. It will be road constructors. It will be bridge experts. And they do this through different working groups. They have, for example, a recorders group, a human factors group, an engineering group, a shipping practices group. And they divide up the work to all these different groups, and then they report back together and coordinate. And that's how they get these massive jobs done on this and any other NTSB investigation of this magnitude. And then they also will cover literally everything. Some things that you or I or other people might think are red herrings that don't have anything to, you know, might not be significant here. They will cover each one of those and systematically rule them out. And that's how they avoid investigation bias. If they go in the beginning thinking, well, this doesn't matter, they might be biased. And so the NTSB does not do that. They will literally cover every single aspect of this through various working groups. Oh, and by the way, they do have to bring in and are bringing in the Ministry of Transport of Singapore, because they are a party to this investigation as well because of the flagging of the ship. And that's how they'll get the work done. And they always manage to do it.
Yeah, it's so important right now. Everyone's got to learn the lessons of what went wrong to make sure it never happens again. Captain Ahlstrom, you're an expert on maritime safety. From your understanding right now, did the ship's team do everything they could? Was there any way to have prevented this horrible collapse?
No, I think the ship's crew did everything they could. They had a man standing by on the bow, which, again, the investigation will prove. The anchors were ready to be let go. Unfortunately, they lost power at the wrong time, and possibly they put the engines astern, which may have pushed the bow to starboard. And again, I'm a big fan of having tug escorts. They did not have a tug escort. It wasn't required. But I do believe that this crew was well-trained. They are STCW qualified. They complied with SOLAS. They were licensed. And I believe the pilots did a fantastic job. But unfortunately, it was Murphy's Law. And we trained our cadets. I always say, going to sea is 99% boredism and 1% sheer terror. And what you do in that 1% will depend if you stay alive or still have a license. And they did the best they could with what the hand they were dealt.
Let me go back to Mary right now. Mary, as you know, cargo ships like this one, the Dolly, have gotten much bigger over the years. What improvements should be made to American infrastructure right now to accommodate that and to ensure that no other bridges and ports are at risk?
Well, I think newer bridges already have made many of those considerations. You know, some of the newest bridges and a lot of their suspension bridges do incorporate what they call, you know, fenders or, if you will, barriers around the bridge supports. They do include what they call dolphins, or if you would think of it as giant cement and rock cylinders, and they are reinforced. They have additional standards. For example, there's a new suspension bridge in Charleston, South Carolina, replaced an old bridge very much like this, 2 miles long, 100,000 vehicles a day. It cost almost $1 billion, and it was finished ahead of schedule, but it has more modern things, such as the supports, the additional restructuring. The entire bridge is covered with cameras, and that's the state of the art now. And they learned a lot of those lessons from accidents, because a ship hitting a bridge is unfortunately not rare, not in the U.S. and not around the world.
Yeah, such important steps indeed. Captain Ahlstrom, how challenging is the undertaking right now to move the debris out of the way, refloat this ship, and get the port up and running again?
No, I think the getting the stuff out of the way is one issue, but I want to add to what Mary said. All these bridges have barriers around them. That new construction has that. I don't understand why the grandfathering these older bridges were built when the ships were smaller. And again, a small 500-foot freighter hitting that bridge is not the same as the 1,000-foot, 95,000-ton container ship. And once that vessel hits it, we need to eliminate this grandfathering, that these bridges need to be adjusted right now. Getting that equipment out of there, that's a whole other issue. And I think the congressman addressed that well, that we're looking at a long-term plan here.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Captain Joseph Ahlstrom, Mary Schiavo, to both of you, thank you very much. Coming up, we expect that news conference on the bridge disaster to begin only minutes from now. We're going to take it live as soon as it happens. Stand by for that. Plus, my interview with retired U.S. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. I'll get his thoughts on concerns over the court's future and the public's declining trust in the highest court.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon, and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
You're looking at live pictures of Baltimore County right now, where officials are scheduled to give an update on the bridge collapse this hour. We'll bring that to you live as soon as it begins. Stand by for that. But first, the U.S. Supreme Court at a critical moment right now, the nine justices weighing politically explosive issues like abortion and Donald Trump's claims of presidential immunity amid declining public trust in the institution and questions about its future. And joining me now, the retired United States Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. He's the author of a very important and powerful brand new book entitled Reading the Constitution, Why I Chose Pragmatism, Not Textualism. Justice Breyer, thank you very much for joining us. I want to discuss your book. We're going to get to that. But among other things, you've said that on its current path right now, the Supreme Court is producing, and these are your words, a constitution that no one wants. What are the implications of that for the country?
Well, that's not a good implication for the country. And where I say that frequently was Nino Scalia and I used to discuss in public the differences in our approach to the Constitution.
I remember.
And statutes, too. And he would say, I have too complicated the system. Only you, Stephen, can do it. And then I'd say to him, but if we follow you, Nino, we'll have a constitution that no one would want.
Interesting. So you're sticking by those words, that we're producing a constitution that no one wants.
Well, if you follow, now, not everybody knows what this word textualism means, much less originalism.
What does it mean?
What does it mean? It means when you look at a statute, you see some words. When you look at this document, the Constitution, there are more words. That's what lawyers do. They look at words. And sometimes those words are not clear as to how they apply, and then the case might get to the Supreme Court. And how will you decide what those words mean, how they apply? A textualist or an originalist says, I'll tell you how. Go read them. Read them and don't look at much else. Just read those words. Read them twice. Three times. So I say, hey, I have a word called costs, you know, in the statute. This word says costs. And does it apply to an educational expert, too, or not? Read it 10 times. You know what it'll say the 10th time?
Cost.
Correct. Yeah. Cost.
All right. That's right. Let's talk a little bit about, and you retired at the end of the Supreme Court session of 2022.
That's right.
Of the Dobbs decision, and you were there, that overturned Roe versus Wade, mm-hmm. you wrote this, so let me read it to you. Mm-hmm. None of the traditional considerations that had led the court to overrule prior precedent could justify its decision in Dobbs. Changes in the facts supported rather than undermined Roe and Casey. So how damaging has this been, you believe, this decision, this so-called Dobbs decision, to the credibility of the Supreme Court?
I don't know to the credibility because you are the expert there. I have my own ideas.
But You're an expert.
Well, I am a member of the Supreme Court. But we wrote a long dissent. Who? Justice Kagan, Justice Sotomayor, and myself. And that dissent together said this would be very harmful. The majority thinks it's going to turn the whole issue over to the legislatures of states, and we'll never have to deal with it again. Oh, really? We said, is that true? Well, this morning, I think, or yesterday morning, wasn't it? They dealt with a big issue, and there will be more and more and more. And we wrote all of that.
Because of the Dobbs decision.
Yes. We wrote that overturn and said, this is not going to work well. This is not going to work well, and we explained it.
So are you worried about the court's credibility?
I'm worried in this sense, yes. Yes and no. Good question. Why? If you, not you, but someone, were on trial, and suppose that person was very unpopular, that's why I say it's not you, very unpopular, would that person want a judge who is going to decide according to public opinion? No. Well, that's true, but in the long run, public opinion matters because public opinion is one of the things that will lead people to follow a rule of law.
And I want to follow up on that. But you've also said that if the court overturns too many decisions, in your words, it could lead to legal chaos. Do you think that's the path that we're all heading on?
No. But I think what will happen there is this. The people who have textualism, originalism,
the conservative justices.
Yes, and as it turns out. But they say one of the problems with the way I approach the Constitution, maybe you would, is that one of the problems is it lets a judge substitute what he thinks is good for the law. And I say, oh, really? Read Dobbs. How did you pick out Roe v. Wade to overturn? Are you going to overturn every case that doesn't decide by a theory of textualism? That's the question you ask. Mm-hmm. And the answer to that is no, of course not, because that would lead to a country without laws. But how do you decide? Perhaps you decide on the ground you think that's a really wrong case. Well, then what are you criticizing the other side for?
Yeah.
Both sides have that problem.
As you know, the American public has soured on the Supreme Court, at least in recent years. I'll put some numbers up on the screen. In 2020, nearly two-thirds of Americans approved of the Supreme Court. But since then, approval for the court has plummeted, now standing at just 40%. Are you concerned about this declining public opinion support for the Supreme Court?
Remember, there were two halves. You want judges who will not decide according to what the public approves or disapproves. On the other hand, and the person who said this very well was Professor Paul Freund at Harvard years ago, he said, no judge will decide a case according to the political temperature of the day. But every judge will take account of the climate of the era. Now, you get too much, too opposed to what the courts are doing, and you will discover weaknesses in the rule of law itself. Because the rule of law itself means you and others and me will have to sometimes follow cases that they think are wrong. If you don't have that attitude in the country, you don't have a rule of law. And that, I think, would be unfortunate.
I want to get to a huge issue that's before the Supreme Court right now. The justices, as you know, are going to hear presidential immunity arguments, the case that Trump is putting forward. Mm-hmm. He says he has presidential immunity and should not be tried. They could have taken this up back in December, but they didn't. Why do you think they delayed this until now? Are they afraid? You think they're afraid of Trump?
I don't like to criticize any question, but there are certain questions I really can't go into.
I know.
Because I am a retired justice, and I don't want to be a 10th justice telling other people what to do.
The American public would love to hear your thoughts on presidential immunity on this case, which is such a significant case before the Supreme Court.
They might, but it is in the area where I feel I can't go into.
It's because it would be inappropriate.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
You retired from the Supreme Court at the end of the 2022 session. Should other justices, do you believe, and I hope you can answer this question, should other justices follow your example and step aside from the court so it doesn't necessarily tilt further to the right?
It's very much a personal decision. And it's a difficult decision. And people all over this country who've reached the age where it's possible that retirement is in the sights will have to make that decision. And I can't say more than it's a personal decision. Would I think that the makeup of the court might feed in there as one of the factors? It might for me, but it's about me.
Why did you decide to retire when you did?
I did. I was 83 years old. I was getting on. There were a lot of, you want to give chances to other people. You want to take into account to some degree what's happening and what the court might look like in the future. What's your family situation? What about your grandchildren? What about?
So you thought about all that.
Oh, my goodness. How do you think about decisions that affect you personally?
It's not just you personally. It's the country. There's such a powerful and important position on the United States Supreme Court. Let me just wrap this up because I know you got to go. What do you hope your legacy will be as far as the American judicial system is concerned?
I can't do better than say what Sandra O'Connor told me when Thurgood Marshall and she were discussing that question. He was a little gloomy. He said, I don't know if I've really accomplished anything. Sandra said, my goodness, Thurgood, you've accomplished more than I think anybody on this court has accomplished. What is your legacy going to be? He said, I know what I'd like it to be. I'm guessing from what I've heard. He said, he tried. That's the virtue of that job. It gives you a chance to do your best. It's not the applause. I was told by a president, hey, the applause dies very rapidly, very rapidly. And then you're left with the job. And the virtue of that job is it requires you to forget about yourself. You know what Ken Galbraith said when he'd been ambassador in India? He'd been ambassador, and one of his colleagues said, yes, interesting, Ken. And he said, you know what was so interesting? I found I didn't think about myself for seconds at a time. That's it.
All right, the book is entitled Reading the Constitution, Why I Chose Pragmatism, Not Textualism. Yes. We're all going to learn a lot more about textualism and pragmatism reading this important book. And Justice Breyer,
thank you.
Thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you.
And thanks for all your good work. Appreciate it over these many years.
Thank you very much.
And up next, officials in Baltimore, including the governor, are about to give an update on the bridge collapse. We're going to bring that to you live as soon as it begins, momentarily. Plus, Democrats plan to beat Donald Trump in November. We're going to tell you how former presidents Obama and Clinton are now teaming up with the Biden campaign. There's more breaking news we're following right now. Former U.S. Senator and vice presidential nominee Joe Lieberman is dead at the age of 82. His family says he suffered complications from a fall. Right now, I want to bring in our political commentator, Alyssa Farah Griffin, our senior political commentator, Van Jones, and CNN chief political correspondent, Dana Bash. You and I covered Joe Lieberman for many years. Talk a little bit about his legacy as far as our country is concerned.
Well, he certainly was one of the most, maybe the most pious politician that I ever covered and ever met. And he was well known as a very important Jewish figure. But it's not just that he was Jewish, Wolf. It's that he was an observant Jew, very open and proud of his Judaism and his traditions. And that, no question, led him through a very long career of politics. I mean, he started out in the Connecticut State House. Then he became Attorney General in Connecticut, and then, of course, was a senator in the U.S. Senate for almost a quarter century. And, well, he was very well known as pretty hawkish on defense issues and on some domestic issues. Some of his positions when it came to international relations certainly set him apart from his party, and that led to some fraying with the Democratic Party, so much so that even though he was the vice presidential pick for Al Gore in 2000 and came within a little more than 500 votes of becoming vice president of the United States, it wasn't that long afterwards that he maybe about a decade, not even, that he was challenged from within his own party in the United States Senate, at Connecticut Senate Democratic primary, and he lost. And then he ran as an independent and he won again. And that kind of sums up the career of Joe Lieberman. The other thing that I think people might not realize is that the entire Department of Homeland Security, Wolf, was created in large part because it was his idea, along with others, but his main idea. He spearheaded the idea after 9/11 of bringing all of these disparate departments and agencies that didn't communicate well enough pre-9/11 into one umbrella organization, and that is the Department of Homeland Security. And that was in a large part what he did. And I will say that we're already getting statements from his former colleagues, Chuck Schumer, saying how devastated he is. Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, who often traveled with Senator Lieberman, Senator McCain, Senator Graham, said that she is simply heartbroken. And we're going to continue to hear that throughout the evening. There's no question about it.
Yeah, a lot of us who knew Joe Lieberman well are heartbroken right now. Van Jones, Lieberman was the vice presidential candidate with Al Gore, as we all remember, back in 2000. How do you think Democrats in general right now should remember him?
Well, I mean, it's kind of the tale of two Joe Liebermans. Why was he the vice presidential pick? You know, we have a big party. A lot of people could have filled that role. Coming out of the 90s, the Bill Clinton White House had been rocked by scandal. There was a sense that maybe Bill Clinton was a tarnished figure. And Al Gore had to figure out, how can I signal to people that this is going to be a button-up operation, this is going to be a high-integrity operation, my White House is going to be run by adults, I'm going to get Joe Lieberman. Because his reputation, his standing, the esteem that he was held by the whole country, that was the biggest single way he could signal the kind of man he wanted to be associated with, and it was very important for Gore at that time. And so, and again, as was just said, came within a couple hundred votes of becoming the first Jewish vice president, would have made history doing that, and given his heart for service, would have been a fantastic vice president, no doubt. At the same time, when McCain ran against Obama, Joe Lieberman actually endorsed John McCain, which on the one hand is a beautiful statement of bipartisanship, on the other hand was heartbreaking for Obama folks like myself to see a great figure like that walk across the street and hold hands with the other side. And that is also Joe Lieberman, independent, tough-minded, isn't going to go with popular opinion, is going to go with his own heart. Sometimes that helped Democrats, sometimes it hurt our feelings, but a lion of the Senate and a legendary figure for sure.
Let me get Alyssa Vera Griffin into this conversation. Alyssa, Joe Lieberman was very, very, very independent-minded. He joined with the Republicans from time to time, as we all know. How do you see his legacy?
Well, first, I just want to say condolences to Senator Lieberman's family, his wife Hadassah. I mean, he was truly a consummate statesman. And in hearing this news, I couldn't help but feel like this is in some ways the end of an era. He really encapsulated the idea of bipartisanship and championing the idea of working across the aisle. He saw it as a virtue. He didn't feel like he had to fit into one box or only play for one tee. He truly focused on the priorities of the American people. And he's such an interesting person to reflect on in this political moment because he so strongly decried toxic partisanship. I mean, a remarkable legacy to Van's point that he was on a Democratic presidential ticket and was very seriously considered years later to be on a Republican presidential ticket. I think it speaks to his character, the seriousness of who he was in the Senate as the statesman, as this policymaker, but also someone who is just universally respected by both sides of the aisle.
Yeah, it's so true indeed. Everyone stand by for a moment. I want to bring in a longtime aide to Joe Lieberman. Dan Gerstein is joining us right now. Dan, our deepest condolences for your loss. I know you worked very closely with Senator Lieberman over these years. How are you remembering him tonight?
Well, thank you, Wolf. It's a sad day, still in a little bit of a shock. I guess hearing some of the other guests talk about the two I's, as we like to say, integrity and independence. And you know, those are the values that Senator Lieberman stood for, will always be remembered for. I, as much as I'm sad, I'm also grateful for the opportunity to have worked from him, worked with him, but also learned from him. I've learned so much about not just politics and policy, but respect for other people, for different viewpoints. And one of my favorite things about him and what I will always take away is when we were at events and we were, you know, maybe backstage or in the kitchen, he would always take time to talk to the catering staff, the bartenders, and make them feel seen and show respect to them. And that really said a lot about his character.
Yeah, it certainly did. You were a top advisor at Senator Lieberman's side through multiple campaigns. Tell us a little bit more about your experiences with Senator Lieberman over the past few decades.
Sure. You know, one of my favorite experiences was, and this was really my first experience working for him full time, was on his 94 reelection campaign, which he was in a dominant position. It was not much of a contest. But he still campaigned hard and went out and met with voters as, again, as a sign of respect for the process, for the democratic process. And we came up with the idea that he had been visiting diners off and on as a way to kind of interact with real people, real voters. And we put together a tour, and I had the opportunity to kind of drive with him and oftentimes drive him to on some early morning stops to diners across Connecticut. And again, it was remarkable to see a man who was very comfortable sitting in boardrooms with CEOs, in meetings with heads of state, with presidents of the United States, but also being very comfortable talking to cops, factory workers, teachers, the kind of people he would meet in diners, and take their questions and take them seriously. And he was as much as he was a statesman and a master of policy and negotiated some very important piece of legislation, he also was a master retail politician. And it's a rare combination these days, particularly in the digital era.
So bottom line, Dan, what do you see as Senator Lieberman's legacy right now?
Well, I mean, I think the word statesman, I think, will be attached to his name and integrity. And sorry, phone is ringing off the hook. The way he worked across the aisle and tried to build coalitions in an era when compromise increasingly became a dirty word, he still believed in the power of compromise and being in the position to, build agreement and forge consensus from people from different viewpoints. Because he's always said the only way thing you can get things done in Washington is through the center out and having bipartisan buy-in, not just to get the votes, but to have legitimacy for the policies that passed. And I think we're seeing the consequences now of that lack of compromise, that lack of consensus in our politics.
And he was very open and proud of his Jewish faith, wasn't he? Talk a little bit about that.
Oh yeah. And, as someone who was not observant, I learned a lot about Judaism from him and Jewish values. And again, that's one of the things I always respected and admired him for was, it's one thing to be a man of faith. It's quite another thing to live your values and honor your faith every day in your work, how you treat people. A lot of it just started with his mother. I think you remember Wolf, Marcia, and what a special relationship they had. One of my fondest remembrances of the campaign was in 2000, when he was the vice presidential nominee, was so many evangelical Christians coming up to him telling how much they admired him and as a man of principle and a man of faith. And I think that showed the best of America was that, the way that we, the civic religion and what binds us together has, for most of our history, been much stronger than our differences.
Yeah, good point. Dan Gerstein, thank you very much for joining us. Our deepest condolences to you and to the Lieberman family right now. I want to bring back Dana Bash. Dana, let me get some final thoughts from you as well. As I said before, you and I covered Joe Lieberman for many years.
Well, first of all, that was beautiful from Dan Gerstein, who I got to know when he was working for Senator Lieberman back in the day. I think one of the things that I always think about with Joe Lieberman is he grew up in an Orthodox community in Stamford, Connecticut. And I actually got to know him separately from the U.S. Senate because he grew up with two of the fathers of two people I know very well, two of my friends, one of whom lost her father quite young. And Senator Lieberman said to her, "I will always be there for you." And he promised her father that he would be. And he was. She just recently got a new job. She just told him about it. And that's the kind of man, that's the kind of mensch, if you will, that Joe Lieberman was personally. And his politics, obviously, were, as Van really brilliantly laid out, very complicated. But his North Star was compromise, the center, and trying to overcome the extremes in both parties. And he will be missed. And as you say so well, may his memory be a blessing.
Yes, indeed. All right, Dana, thank you very, very much. We will all miss him. We'll take a quick break. Much more of our news right after this.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Tonight, Barack Obama is stepping up his efforts to help President Biden keep the White House. Democrats looking to rebuild President Biden's winning coalition and beat Donald Trump again. CNN's MJ Lee has more.
Joe Biden.
Barack Obama jumping into the 2024 election, hoping he can help his former Vice President Joe Biden win a second term at the White House. The former president making clear to associates in recent months that he believes the Biden-Donald Trump rematch in November will be incredibly close, and that he sees the election as an all-hands-on-deck moment, sources tell CNN.
As you know, Joe is an extraordinary friend and partner. He was by my side for 8 years.
Last Friday, Obama spending several hours in the White House residence, recording videos for the Biden campaign, including about the Affordable Care Act.
There's nothing I'm more proud of than the ACA.
Off camera, Obama telling Biden that the president's State of the Union remarks this month appear to have broken through, and that he believes health care will once again be a potent issue in the upcoming election. Passage of that landmark health care law, one of the hallmark achievements of the Obama presidency. That 14 years later, President Biden is continuing to tout.
I thought it was a big deal at the time. Well, it's even a bigger deal today.
Sources telling CNN that the two presidents, who have made much of their friendship and so-called bromance, still speak regularly.
This also gives the internet one last chance to talk about our bromance.
And that Obama is also in direct contact with some senior White House officials, including Chief of Staff Jeff Zients. On Thursday, three U.S. presidents, Biden, Obama, and Bill Clinton, set to appear together for a star-studded fundraiser in New York City, moderated by comedian Stephen Colbert. Tickets to the sold-out evening at Radio City Music Hall, ranging from $225 to a whopping $500,000, and numerous celebrities expected to be in attendance. Some audience members also getting the chance to have their photo taken with the three presidents by famed photographer Annie Leibovitz.
And Wolf, this high dollar fundraiser tomorrow night is expected to be just the beginning of former President Barack Obama's growing involvement with the Biden campaign. And particularly as we start getting into the fall, sources say he is expected and likely to visit college campuses and key cities in key battleground states. And certainly when we see these three presidents on stage together tomorrow night, it is going to highlight the deep anxiety that so many national Democrats are feeling about the prospects of Donald Trump returning to the White House. Wolf?
MJ Lee at the White House for us. MJ, thanks for that report. Our senior political commentator, Van Jones, is back with us right now. Van, how much can former President Obama and former President Bill Clinton's embrace of President Biden's reelection help energize so-called disaffected Democratic voters?
I think it can do a lot. Anybody who underestimates Barack Obama, any time you spend doubting Barack Obama is time wasted. He is a world-class talent. He is the most talented politician of his generation with no peer. And he's coming off the bench. And don't, oh, well, you know, Biden, he's having to hang on to Obama. Don't forget, when Obama was going for re-election, Bill Clinton came off the bench. And Bill Clinton gave an unbelievable speech at the convention and turned the tide for Biden. So this is a tradition that the former president comes out and embraces the present president. But anytime anybody spends doubting Barack Obama's ability to appeal to people, it's just wasting their time. There are disaffected voters in our party. Some of them are young. Some of them are men of color. Barack Obama has a unique ability to cut through to that constituency. That's going to be very, very important. But by the way, there are two Obamas, there are two Clintons, and there are two Bidens, all six of whom are going to be on the court, and I'm excited about it.
Yeah. Do you see Obama's involvement, Van, as more about turning out Democrats to go out and vote for Biden or persuading independent voters?
Like, I think that he has a unique ability to do both. I do think there are people, our base voters need some more encouragement. You're seeing some black voters move away, some male voters move away. He can support, he can help on that. But there are also our independents who remember him as the no red states, no blue states guy. And Obamacare has done a great deal of good for a lot of people. He's a full court utility player, and he's going to do a great job. I'm excited about it.
It's going to be very, very impressive and important. Van Jones, thank you very much. Just ahead, we'll have more on the Baltimore bridge collapse as officials now confirm divers recovered two bodies from the water. We'll have a closer look at the victims and more when we come back. We're following breaking news in the Baltimore Bridge disaster. Officials now revealing just a little while ago that divers have recovered the bodies of two of the six construction workers who were on the bridge working when the cargo ship crashed into it. CNN's Danny Freeman is taking a closer look at the victims.
Early Tuesday morning, a group of workers were on the overnight shift, filling potholes, doing routine surface work on Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge, when the unthinkable happened.
For us and the family in Honduras, we still have hope. I know time is our worst enemy.
Among those presumed dead, 38-year-old Maynor Yacir Suazo Sandoval, a Honduran national, one of eight siblings, a husband, and a father of two. Maynor's brother, Carlos Suazo Sandoval, is desperately waiting for any updates from officials.
He was the breadwinner for his children right now. God is going to provide for us too, so we can get together as a family and see how we can help each other because, at this moment, his wife is left with his girls and everything.
Miguel Luna was a father of three, an immigrant from El Salvador, also presumed dead. Nonprofit CASA announced Luna was a member of their group, which provides services to working-class families from marginalized communities, including immigrants. CASA said Luna lived in Maryland for over 19 years. 26-year-old Dorlian Castillo Cabrera was an immigrant from Guatemala, found dead earlier today. His sister-in-law told CNN he loved his job as a construction worker. His cousin added that Dorlian came to the United States to follow his dream and help his mother. The Guatemalan government confirmed another immigrant from that country was among the missing, but did not provide details.
I'm thankful.
Maryland's governor said he prayed with the families of victims yesterday.
We're hoping for right now that in this moment that we can just bring them a sense of closure after this horrific incident.
Lamentamos mucho la situación.
We are very sorry for the situation of what happened in general.
This morning, Mexico's president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, said three Mexican nationals were also on that bridge when it collapsed. Two died and one survived.
This shows that migrants go to work in the middle of the night, very risky jobs, and that is why they do not deserve to be treated as usually happens by some irresponsible politicians.
Seven of the eight people on the bridge that night worked for local construction company Bronner Builders. In an interview with CNN, its executive vice president, Jeffrey Pritzker, said, quote, "These were wonderful young men. They were doing a tough job. These guys were hardworking, wonderful people, and now they're gone." Wolf, and I want to mention Alejandro Hernandez Fuentes, the 35-year-old who was discovered earlier this morning alongside of Dorley. And one thing, Wolf, is you can see this entire community really has come together around these families. There have been multiple GoFundMes set up. These politicians have come and made multiple promises. And the EVP of the company that many of these men worked for told me he's going to make sure the families are well taken care of. Wolf?
And our deepest condolences to their families. May they rest in peace and may their memories be a blessing. Danny Freeman, thank you very much. Just ahead, we'll have the latest on the human trafficking investigation involving Sean Diddy Combs. What we're learning about his whereabouts as the raids began. Tonight, we're learning new information about the federal human trafficking investigation involving Sean Diddy Combs, including his whereabouts as the raids on his properties began. CNN security correspondent Josh Campbell has our report.
Sean Diddy Combs, seen in this video obtained by TMZ, said to be filmed at a Miami airport. He and his twin teenage daughters were headed away on a planned spring break when federal investigators searched his homes Monday, according to a source close to the musician with direct knowledge of the situation. A video obtained by TMZ said to show the aftermath of the law enforcement action at his home. So far, his current whereabouts are still not publicly known. After Department of Homeland Security investigators searched for documents, phones, computers, and other electronic devices, according to a law enforcement source familiar with the searches. Combs' attorney issued a statement Tuesday calling the search of the homes a gross overuse of military-level force and a witch hunt based on meritless accusations. Claims disputed by law enforcement veterans.
You know, the roundhouse swing he took at the show of force really kind of classic defense attorney tactics to try to turn around a bad press day.
The law enforcement action coming after a series of civil lawsuits alleging Combs' involvement in sex trafficking and sexual abuse, allegations Combs has denied. His attorney statement saying the musician was, quote, never detained, but spoke to and cooperated with authorities.
Until there is an indictment and a potential bail hearing, which could include a limitation on a defendant's travel, you would not expect in this type of case there to be any limitation on his travel.
Combs' legal issues stemming from civil lawsuits, including one filed in February by producer Rodney Jones, also known as Lil Rod, accused Combs of, among other things, sexual assault. And other members of his inner circle also now facing legal issues. Actor Cuba Gooding Jr., named as a defendant in an amended complaint filed by Jones in February. Jones stating in the lawsuit that he believes Combs was grooming him to pass him off to his friends, alleging that Combs suggested Jones get to know Gooding Jr. while on the mogul's yacht in the Virgin Islands last year, and claiming Gooding Jr. began touching, groping, and fondling Jones before he was able to forcibly push him away. The filing included two images described as screenshots from a video of Gooding Jr. with Combs and Gooding Jr. with his arm around Jones. An attorney for Cuba Gooding Jr. has not responded to CNN's request for comment. And on Monday, at the same time as the execution of the search warrants were underway, an arrest of one of Combs' associates, unrelated to the search warrants and the civil lawsuits. 25-year-old Brendan Paul was charged with possession of cocaine and marijuana-laced candy, allegedly found inside his personal travel bags at a Miami airport. Now, we reached out to Paul for comment. We have not yet heard back. You're looking now, Wolf, at new affiliate video that we obtained. That is Sean Combs' Gulfstream 550 executive jet today in Miami. Still no public sign of the singer himself. We have not heard directly from him, nor for that matter have we heard from authorities about what, if anything, they found at those residences, Wolf, and whether any of that information might result in criminal charges.
Josh Campbell reporting. Thank you very much. And to our viewers, thanks very much for watching. I'm Wolf Blitzer in the Situation Room. The news continues on CNN right now.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.